Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And Lizzie. Oh, snap.
Oh, you're the worst.
I'm not
and
Lizzie.
You are Lizzie. But joining
us
today,
I'm Lizzie the worst.
A special guest. A special guest, would you introduce yourself?
Hello. My name is Garrison Davis. I do reporting and podcasting now, I guess. Yeah.
Medical podcasting as well now. Put that on your resume.
That's a bad idea. No one should listen to anything I say relating to that.
No, we're not going to ask you your opinion.
No. We wouldn't bring you on the show to ask you your thoughts. Garrison, you are a very interesting and very cool dude. You are 18, correct?
Yes.
18 years old. You're a videographer. And would you say you're an independent journalist? Is that an accurate assessment of what you want to do?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I work for... Yeah, I mean, I don't work for anyone specifically at the moment. I've done work for Bellingcat. People have bought my footage and reporting before. I've done work for iHeartRadio. I'll be doing more work for them soon. But yeah, I mean,
cool. What's the correct term? Correct me, man.
I don't really know yet. I'm very new. I'm kind of new to the professional world, so I don't really know. I try to reiterate that I'm just kind of a kid. Because a lot of people, I don't know. Yeah, it's the weird thing when you turn into like an internet celebrity, people view you a weird way. And I'm like, no, I'm just someone who started posting footage, and then people started following me on Twitter, and now I'm here.
Well, I have two questions. Would you say you're like a freelance journalist, and are you an internet celebrity?
I hope not. I hope not. But that's always in the eye of the beholder, I think.
Yeah.
You don't really have much say over that. And then, yeah, I guess I do technically do freelance work.
Yeah.
But it's more like I just post stuff, and if people want to pay for it, they can. All my work is available for free.
Yeah.
Always. I don't like charge people to watch my footage, but if a corporation wants to do it, then you sure, I'll suck any corporate money.
Well, we're more honored to have you on our show then. Thank you for coming.
For our listeners who don't know you, because, you know, half of our listeners are probably going to know you from, you know, what has been termed the bastard verse, and
yes,
the other half will not know you because they're all doctors and medical professionals and nurses and such. So you've been documenting a lot of the unrest in Portland, Oregon. You documented the city's Black Lives Matter protests. You've been covering really well, I think, the conflicts between protesters and the police in that city. And I mean, you spent as much time covering this stuff and covering the far right, the alt-right, as most kids your age have put into Fortnite at this point. So you have been doing this for a while. How long have you been doing this for?
Yeah, I've been involved in like I've been really involved in politics for a few years just because of the nature of the city I'm in. It's got, you know, a lot of people in Portland, I think, share that just because we've had far right rallies here basically as long as I can remember. That's just always kind of been a part of life here. We had a neo-Nazi kill two people on one of like our MAX trains. That's like our like city transit. So that's just always a part of life here. And then the past few years I've been getting more into doing kind of research and studying the far right, just specifically out of my own interest. And then when the BLM protests in Portland kicked off last summer, I was going initially just to kind of keep watch to see what kind of far right activity there would be there. Cause at that point in Minneapolis, we were having like Boogaloo Boys and different people kind of show up to try to start things. So I was going just to see if out of my research capacity. And also because I thought, you know, everything that happened in Minneapolis was terrible with the police there. And that should be like universally appalling. And then eventually police started doing the stuff that they do. And because I was there to record stuff, I caught a lot of stuff on camera and people started watching it. And then I became friends with Robert Evans and joined the Bastards Verse. Yeah. I put together a podcast with Robert and a few other people kind of doing a really succinct overview of what happened in 2020, called Uprising, a guide from Portland. It's like a 10 episode miniseries that really puts a really clear picture together of what actually happened. We interviewed dozens and dozens of people, at least more than 50. I think less than 100, mm-hmm. but probably more than 50 people were interviewed for that project. Massive project. Really, really happy with it. It's good to have that resource out there.
I'm definitely going to have to listen to that. I listened to his 6 or 7 part series on Behind the Police. And I thought I'd recommend that to any of our listeners who want to hear about just because Portland, Oregon, I believe, is where policing sort of came to be and developed this kind of a white supremacist take,
yeah.
According to Behind the Bastards, which I really enjoyed. And you say that just being in Portland, like the nature of being in Portland helped motivate you to where you are now and your curiosity, but it has to be maybe even more than that, right? Is that like, is this in your family? Is it, you know, cause you can ignore that stuff. You were 15, 16 when you started this stuff. Like a lot of kids, like Kaveh said, play Fortnite. Like what drew you in other than just being in Portland?
But yeah, touching on the Portland thing briefly, basically the modern, like police unions are basically invented here. Like the functional police union that we have, the police unions that we have across the country all start out in Portland. That's really goes down to like a lot of our modern problems with policing really can be tracked back to here. And then as for me, I mean, I grew up in like what I would consider to be like a Christian cult, different than like, there's like, you know, I'm friends with people who are Christians and they're fine people. But the kind of sect of Christianity I grew up in had a lot of cult-like attributes. And then my family moved to Portland in part to get away from this very unhealthy kind of culture that I grew up in. So like I was always like steeped in like far right ideology through the lens of like a weird type of Christianity. That was just my, like my life. And I didn't really consider that on any level because I was like a kid, right? That's just what you grew up with. You don't really think it's different. It's like different from the rest of the world.
Right. You don't question it.
No, it's just part of you. So like you have your beliefs that you grew up with and you don't really question them for a while. Then after being in Portland for a few years, you just start to discover that there's actually a lot more to the world. And a lot of other people are not like this. And you just, I was always a very curious person. I was always get in trouble when I was in Canada. I was in like a private Christian school run by this same church kind of cult community. I was always get in trouble with the teachers because I would be a very questioning, even still, like, you don't like question some beliefs, but like just like rejection of a whole bunch of like the authoritative structures and questioning a whole bunch of other things that people usually, you don't want kids to talk about. So always very curious. And then I was homeschooled here in Portland. And what that basically meant is that I just kind of schooled myself in many ways. I didn't really listen to my curriculum a lot of the time, which I'm sure parents aren't thrilled with at the time, but I'm sure they're happy with now based on what I've done.
That's a good question. That leads me to wonder how your family is responding to all the stuff that you're doing, particularly because of the background. But even if you didn't come from this sort of cult-like background, what was the name of the cult or the church? What was it called?
I don't want to say the name necessarily, but yeah, it was a sect of evangelicalism.
Okay, that's fine. I wouldn't know it anyways. But like, so even if that wasn't the case, you're in some pretty dangerous situations. You're at these.
Yeah.
You're dealing with some very dangerous individuals online. You get the attention of people on the far right constantly. You're like, your Gab talks about you and posts what you say. I mean, big right-wing groups have taken notice of you. How does your family feel about that? Are your parents concerned? Have they talked to you about your safety? I mean, I'm coming at it from the perspective of a dad, so I'm wondering, you know, how they've been with it.
Yeah, it's a mix of things. I mean, they've been supportive of me and my kind of independent nature for a while. So that's been really nice and helpful. They've kind of like helped me grow as a person, and are, you know, I'm thankful for them, and have been, you know, they've been very, like, and, you know, in part they moved away from this destructive culture for, you know, for me and my siblings, you know, health and well-being. So they've always been supportive of kind of my independence. Let's see, in terms of the protest stuff and safety, I mean, yeah, parents are always going to worry. That's kind of their whole bit. That's kind of their whole job. Yeah, I mean, but like, they, you know, they recognize that I enjoy doing this on some level. I think it's important, you know, it has a healthy impact. And I mean, in terms of like safety and stuff, yeah, I mean, you know, they're always glad to hear I have more bulletproof armor, which is always like a weird thing to hear from your parent.
Don't forget your armor. Right.
I was going to say, you know, to give it the medical spin that we like to do. So, did you see a lot of injuries?
I saw a few people almost die.
Well, I want to hear, I mean, a little bit about that. Not too gory. Sorry. I have like a sensitive stomach. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Don't, or GI doctors. But also we had an ophthalmologist on the episode a few months ago to talk about kind of the tear gas and trauma and rubber bullets. And we've talked to a lot of people about this kind of stuff, and you were there on the ground, and we haven't spoken to anyone who's done, you know, this kind of work. And it is scary. And it, if you haven't heard it from anybody, it is dangerous to your health.
So, oh yeah.
He probably knows.
I'm just letting, if your parents haven't said it, if they're just saying, great job remembering your body armor, dear, I'll say it for them. It is dangerous what you've been doing. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Will you tell us what you saw, or what the worst dangers were, or what you witnessed, or what you experienced yourself?
I mean, there was always like the absurd level of chemical weapons being used, right? We had, at certain days in Portland, we had the tear gas clouds visible via space satellite. Just because, like, and like there was people who thought we were having like weather issues, because they were seeing these clouds. They're like, what are these clouds? And it took them a while to realize, oh no, that's just the tear gas from the city. Like, we had spontaneous tornadoes of tear gas because of the heat from the air and the wind. We would just see like a spinning vortex of tear gas, like not caused by like leaf blowers or anything, but just because of the heat of the chemicals against the cold air. It was like wild. So there is that whole level of like, you know, the ridiculous amount of chemical munitions that I've breathed in the past year, which is probably knocked off a few years off my life, which is just, you know, something that's, you have to deal with. That's just kind of part of the thing. There's that aspect. And in terms of like impact rounds, that's like a whole separate thing, you know, just getting shot directly with things. That's right. Where I saw most of like the blood from Portland. I got a relatively important clip back in July. I was standing next to someone holding a boombox who got shot in the head with an impact munition. I think it was like a quote unquote rubber bullet, which is like, you know, a very thick piece of metal with like a foam tip on it. So he was shot right in the forehead. It cracked his skull open. If he didn't get immediate medical treatment from the medics that were on the scene, that would have been really bad, because it already was really bad. I mean, he did almost die. He had a traumatic brain injury. He had severe hemorrhaging. He had to go through facial reconstruction surgery multiple times. It got infected multiple times. He's still dealing with the effects now. His face is never going to be the same, right? And this is the thing where I just, you know, saw someone bleeding from their head on the street and watched their body go limp, and, you know, that kind of thing. And like, that isn't an isolated incident. That happened multiple times throughout the course of the summer. I know me and Robert Evans, stopped at certain points to help people. We found us bleeding on the street because it just was so commonplace. And it was so chaotic with tear gas raining down from the sky, rubber bullets being fired everywhere, people running, scattering. You would just find people bleeding on the side of the road. That was, an extremely traumatic few months. We're talking about health aspects. There's a whole mental health side with, I've been diagnosed with PTSD. I have therapy. So that's a whole other side of things, right?
Yeah. I have to say this conversation, we will be talking to a psychiatrist who's an expert in guns, and it sounds like it's a perfect kind of combination.
Yeah.
Of crossroads of what's been going on in your life.
In terms of guns, I've had hundreds of guns pointed at me over the past year.
Yeah.
not just from police, from regular, conservatives and far right people. Being threatened with guns is, a regular part of going to any of their events. Mm. I've been punched with guns. I've had people pistol whip me, but hit me with the bunt of their rifle and hit me across the chest with their rifles and stuff. There's a certain level of danger that I'm sure my parents are not thrilled about. But it's kind of part of the job, and I feel like I'm able-bodied enough to do it. I have enough kind of privilege and skill set in certain things that I feel like I'm someone that can do this work, so I may as well do it.
Yeah, well, it's just hearing what you're describing, I can't see why you could get away without some post-traumatic stress from that.
Yeah,
that's a lot. I'm glad that you're seeing somebody to help you with it. That's a lot for anybody to take in, much less an 18-year-old, man. And not to patronize, but it's a lot. And so I think it's really impressive that you take it the way you do in stride. And I think it's even more impressive that you recognize that it's something to seek treatment for, and that's something you kind of need to. And that's probably going to be with you for a while. So I'm glad you're getting help. I'm glad that you see that as an important thing going forward too.
And thank you for your work. It's also really brave and important to, bear witness to this crazy shit that's going on, So it's super brave, maybe a little reckless, but super brave. So we're grateful for the reporting.
Maybe we'll get you to play a little Fortnite. As a treat. Maybe we'll do a little gaming later. All right, man. Well, I think we're gonna have to have you back on just discuss more of this stuff in the future. I think there's a lot to cover with what you've seen and what you're dealing with.
Yeah, sure.
But our next guest that's gonna be coming up in just a moment, I think there's a lot that overlaps here. Her name is Amy Barnhorst. She's the vice chair of psychiatry at UC Davis. She's an emergency psychiatrist. She's done a lot of work in regards to gun violence research. And we're going to talk to her a little bit about gun violence research in general, and then see if she has any info on gun violence and the far right. And maybe we'll talk a little Star Wars, because I know you like Star Wars, and I would love to talk a little Star Wars with someone else that actually knows about Star Wars, because I don't think Lizzie's seen more than the original.
That's probably good. Yeah, I pretend that I know a lot.
You need to.
For the sake of society and my nieces, but otherwise I really don't know anything about it.
I'm going to say some controversial stuff about the prequels that came out.
Uh-huh.
I fell asleep, everyone. I just fell asleep.
They're not as bad as you think. That's all I'm going to say. Yes, they're totally racist.
They are a little racist.
They're super racist. I don't know what happened, how in this whole set of, thousands of people, nobody was able to be like, hey, wait a minute, this seems a little bit off.
Yeah.
But that's, if you can get past that, which is a big if.
Look, I can excuse racism, but I draw the line at whatever, insert meme here. Yeah. Anyway.
Right. Anyways, so maybe we'll talk about that. Anyways, so everyone stay tuned. As always, thank you, Nadine, for helping us get these episodes out. If you haven't already, please follow us at Twitter @TheHouseOfPod. And Garrison, where can people find you online?
You can find me at Hungry Bowtie on Twitter. There you'll see, you know, various reporting on like police brutality, far right stuff, other protest information. At Twitter is one place. Also, I guess my YouTube channel, which is I think the same name at Hungry Bowtie. And then if you want to listen to my podcast work, Uprising, A Guide from Portland, wherever you get your podcasts. And I also occasionally go on Behind the Bastards.
You know, if you have the chance to listen to the podcast, if you have a chance to watch his YouTube, it's really good. I mean, it's not like good for a young person. It's good. So you should watch it and you'll learn a lot about what's happening. We certainly did. So everyone, check him out. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Listen to some beautiful music from the band The Resurrection Men. And welcome back. Today, we have with us Dr. Amy Barnhorst. She's the Vice Chair of Psychiatry at UC Davis. She is an emergency psychiatrist. She is now a returning guest here at the House of Pod. It's nice to see you again, Dr. Barnhorst. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me back.
We just tell Garrison and us and our listeners what it means to be an emergency psychiatrist. Is it specifically, you know, in the emergency room or the emergency department, or is it only for emergencies, whether it's inpatient, outpatient? What does that title mean for you?
It's a good question. It's kind of a mindset. I mean, I think really I am at heart an emergency medicine physician, but I have to go to bed at 10 o'clock sharp every night. And so that was clearly not going to work out as a career choice for me. But most of my friends are ER docs, my, you know, docs who are physicians. And I was really into like climbing and backcountry skiing and all the outdoor sports. And I had a lot of Patagonia jackets. So I just
That's straight up ER stuff. Garrison, just so you know, there are stereotypes for every field of medicine. Right. And like that is, she's describing what an ER doctor is like, basically, with an outfit.
Does it help your mental health to kind of like to go on outdoor adventures?
Oh my God, yes.
Yes, actually. And that was maybe what got me into psychiatry on some level. But the part of me that also is like a little bit scatterbrained and ADHD and needs a lot of, you know, surprises and uncertainty and lack of structure, that was also the ER doc inside me. And so emergency psychiatry is kind of like a practice model that mimics emergency medicine in some ways, but you only see psychiatric cases. So I mostly work in, I used to work in a crisis unit for a long time, and then I work a little bit in the emergency room, seeing patients on involuntary holds. I work in a jail, and I work in a psych hospital. So I do some inpatient stuff too, but I sort of identify more with the emergency side of things, and I don't do any outpatient work like that. I think that would just be the end of me. I would be terrible at it. My patients would hate me. I would hate it.
You are an emergency room physician or emergency department physician. I do have a question, but how do you know that about yourself when in your 20s, when you're making your career choices, that you have to go to bed at 10 p.m. every night? Because that's the thing that now that Kaveh and I, around the 40-year-old mark and above, like I see my friends who are overnight docs, anesthesia, emergency room, hospitalists, ICU docs, who I see, I think maybe are questioning their choices. And you know, when you're in your mid-20s, you think that you can stay up all night. And how did you know that about yourself in your mid-20s? I'm genuinely very curious.
Well, for one thing, I didn't start medical school till I was 28.
Very smart.
I was a little bit older. And then I, you know, consistently got pregnant throughout medical school. So by the time I started my intern year, by the time I started applying to residency, I had a nursing infant and a 1.5-year-old.
Yeah. So you were forced into the decision.
Yeah. It became very clear to me that I was not, for example, going to do a surgical residency. And I also was just so tired from like having, I mean, I remember the first night I was on medicine call as a intern, I was like, this is the best night of sleep I've gotten in years. Because all I had to answer was my pager. There was no babies waking me up, no toddlers coming in, nobody wet the bed. Like, it was awesome.
That's awesome.
Garrison, we might convince you to go into medicine by the end of this.
That's right?
It's not going to happen.
You've seen enough blood. I think you can handle it.
But I mean, I'm sure I could handle that aspect, but I can't do school. Oh, it's not going to work.
That is a big part of it. So, Amy, you know, we always talk about whether or not it's a good time, quote unquote, to talk about gun violence. I mean,
it's always a
question about whether or not it's a good time to discuss it. But let me ask you, what effect has the pandemic seemed to have had so far on gun violence?
Well, interestingly, some research done by the folks I work with at the UC Firearm Center shows that there's been a lot of new firearm purchases in California during the pandemic. So over the summer, there was a big bump in people who went out and bought guns, and a significant number of those people were first-time firearm owners. And I think with a lot of the, you know, the pandemic itself, the run on supplies that kind of gave this post-apocalyptic feel of, you know, we need to like homestead and defend our territory, the racial violence that went on, the distrust with the police and with the government's handling of the pandemic and the police handling of, you know, various killings of Black men, people became very distrustful of the authorities' ability to keep them safe. And so I think that was what fueled a lot of this. And survey data shows that a lot of the people who bought firearms were doing so not because they were taking up hunting or target shooting, they did it for self-protection.
Yep. Yeah, that tracks with a lot of the stuff I've been watching in my kind of political spheres, studying first-time gun buyers, both on the left and the right. You know, because there's people on the right who definitely bought a lot of firearms because they were scared of Antifa breaking into their house, which I saw a lot of that talk over the summer, which is very silly because that's like never, ever happened. And yeah, that I've also seen, like, I know a lot of people personally, this is more like anecdotal, who were, you know, buying their first ever firearms. I acquired my first ever firearm. It's not actually technically mine yet. It's still at Robert's house because I need to finish the transfer. But I bought most of the materials for it. Right. So yeah, that's definitely something I've also witnessed in the political extremism community. We've seen a lot of encouraging people to buy stuff. And also, bullets have been sold out since like March.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the theme, right? The theme of, I think, the Trump era. And I don't think this is an overstatement or just super liberal ideology, but I think most people would agree that there's been a lot of fear mongering. I think encouraging fear on both sides has been kind of the political kind of, you know, strategy on both sides is, you know, oh, it's the far right, it's the Proud Boys on one side, it's Antifa on the other. And I think that has encouraged probably this increase in gun sales. Amy, yeah. Can you speak to that? Do you know, like, is there obviously?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a huge part of it, right? Is that it used to be, I don't know, 20, 30, how long ago were the 80s and 70s? Long time ago. people bought guns for hunting and for, you know, target shooting. And now the culture for reasons for ownership has really shifted to self-protection. There's not good evidence that having a gun makes your home any safer. In fact, if anything, having a gun in the home increases the risk of both firearm suicide and firearm violence for other people in the home. But, you know, we're Americans, and so every American thinks, well, statistics don't apply to me. I am a And, right. You know, that may be true for certain people who are very well trained, who store their guns very safely and have specific situations for them. But the fear is a big driver. And we've also seen a really big bump in Black Americans buying guns because of so much of the racial tension and the distrust of the police and authority figures. And that there's been a big bump in that as well.
Well, yeah, it sounds like gun sales have gone up sort of universally. And of all the groups that buy it, there are ones that scare me much more than mm-hmm. others. So in terms of what we're seeing with, you know, white supremacists or domestic terrorism, do we have any information on guns in those areas? Are they buying guns? Are they making guns? What are ghost guns, for the love of God? Can you tell me a little bit about this?
Ghost guns are they're kind of a nebulous concept, but what that refers to is guns that don't have a traceable serial number that, you know, that links them back to a registered purchase. And so one of the problems is that now with 3D printing really taking off, you can buy, you don't actually have to register a gun if you, I believe it's 20%, if only 20% of it is purchased and 80% of it is fabricated. So what people do is they buy the parts that are really hard to, for example, print with your 3D printer, and then they print the other parts. And so some of those guns you don't even legally have to register, but then other ones, you know, are just, they don't have serial numbers, they're not traceable. So they're guns that kind of are hard to track in circulation. And obviously they're popular amongst folks who don't want their guns ownership tracked.
This is also, the legality of this varies greatly on the state you live in. Mm-hmm. I know California has much stricter laws about 3D printing guns and production and producing your own guns. Oregon has much looser laws about that. And yeah, I've noticed a growing trend on both the right and the left, and even people that would consider themselves apolitical, who just kind of want to just be more anti-government in general, but really aren't actually tied to, you know, usually when you think of like anti-government types, usually kind of defaults like kind of more people that are like far right libertarians. You know, these are really people that are kind of trying to be just be more apolitical, and they've really skyrocketed the popularity of 3D printed firearms and the production of such.
And in terms of their efficacy as guns, I mean, I don't know that much about guns.
They work very
well. I was like on a scale of 0 to 10. How well do they kill people?
Do they kill people? Well? They kill.
Yeah, they've really increased in quality from, like, you know, there used to be a meme like, oh, if you shoot a 3D printed gun, you're gonna blow your hand off. That's not the case anymore. You can 3D print your own AR-15 lower receivers to build your gun out of. You can 3D print receivers for Glock 19s, Glock 17s. There's like guns that are just like unique to the 3D printer, like the popular FGC9. They're really, really growing in popularity, and they absolutely work. They're not the 3D printed guns of like 10 years ago. These really are quite functional weapons.
So people are buying more guns. They're getting through these loopholes or these legal kind of limitations. And I assume, does that translate to more gun violence and deaths from guns?
You know, I haven't seen official data from 2020 was last year in terms of gun deaths, but I do feel like I have seen some smaller data sets that say that homicides and gun violence have gone up during the pandemic. Although suicides, it's not super clear yet.
I know in Portland, we definitely have seen because I track like the police here and stuff. We definitely have seen an increase in homicides with use of guns. And usually people here attribute that to mostly economic anxiety. And when people face hard times, usually violence also goes up. We've definitely seen an increase of gun violence here. But I would be interested to see what your perspective is on this, Amy. Because I've yet to see much definitive stuff tying self-manufactured weapons to actual, like a really big parallel between like building your own guns and actually doing violence. Most of the kind of the big acts of violence that I've seen is usually with registered weapons. When I think of mass shootings, right? That's like everyone's like big fear, right? Because I know handguns kill way more people every year, but everyone's big fear is like a mass shooting with an AR-15. And from what I can tell, that no one's ever used a 3D printed gun for a mass shooting. But I don't know a whole bunch about this. So I would like to see if you have any insights on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. There is sort of this fear of like, oh, 3D printed guns and, you know, people will just be committing mass shootings right and left. But the truth is that most mass shooters are perfectly eligible to go out and legally purchase a firearm. So why would they bother? Mm-hmm. And there's not that much in the prohibitory statutes for most people who have been perpetrators of mass shootings that would push them into having to use a 3D printed gun or even an illegal gun. There's been relatively few cases of mass shooters who haven't been able to buy their own guns. And a couple of those were the ones that I know of, actually, with the exception of maybe one, it's because they were minors.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the one prohibitory thing. But if they can get it from their parents.
And they get it from their parents. Yeah. Or like a family member they can acquire a gun from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, bringing it back to the emergency psychiatry or emergency medicine. I believe that there's 4 states maybe, and Dr. Barnhart, maybe you could speak to this, where in an emergency room, you're not allowed to ask a patient if they have firearms in their home. So can you answer that? Like, is that real? Because I definitely read that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, but I haven't revisited that. And then tell us about your project in California called Bullet Points.
So, there was a law, it was passed in Florida many years ago. I think this was in 2014, 2015, that made it allegedly illegal for physicians to ask patients about the presence of firearms in the home, but it even said in that law that if it was clinically relevant, they could do it.
Okay.
So, you know, okay, that was pretty loose. And even then, the law was very quickly overturned, and it was only in Florida that it ever happened.
But I assume it's Florida and Texas and like right. Arizona, like the ones, right. the dumps. No, I'm just kidding. They're not the dumb states.
Okay. I mean, in this case, it was just Florida. It was this whole Docs versus Glocks thing that was highly publicized. But people, people got wind of that. And I have heard that repeated so many times. I just did some of my continuing education stuff for my boards. And I read these articles that they had vetted. And I read a great one about gun violence, except that they mentioned that in some states, it's illegal to ask, you know, patients about firearm ownership, which it's not. I was on CNN once with Sanjay Gupta, who said that it's illegal to ask patients about firearm ownership, which it's not. So it was never really illegal if clinically relevant. And even then, that was only like maybe possibly illegal in Florida for 1 year. It's totally legal to ask patients about that. And that's what the project I'm working on that you mentioned is really about. It's about physicians and other healthcare providers. So mental health care and medical health care, nurses, social workers, marriage and family therapists, anyone who's interacting with patients or clients. It's educating them about the risks of gun violence, gun suicide, accidental injury, and how they can work with patients to reduce that risk. So it's just giving them a whole toolbox in the form of a website, continuing education videos, medical education materials for people who teach in medical schools or nursing schools or social work schools, how to bring gun violence prevention into the curriculum.
Well, that's great. So, I have a question that I know you've been asked a million times before, but I feel like it's important to touch upon, particularly this close to International Women's Day. But can you tell us about the red flags that prognosticate someone is going to perpetuate some act of gun violence? What are they?
Well, it's really hard because all of the things I could tell you that are red flags are very common. So they're not sensitive and they're not specific. They don't single out people for these acts, and they don't predict these acts. If we're talking about suicide, you know, there are risk factors for suicide, but again, there are things like having a diagnosis of depression, heavy alcohol use, poor impulse control, relationship loss. Lots of people have these things. If we're talking about mass shootings, it's, you know, a history of feeling that you didn't get something you were entitled to, carrying grievances, making sort of veiled negative threatening comments to peers, social isolation and withdrawal. I mean, a lot of this could be like any teenage boy. So it's really hard to look at the things that we always look backwards in time. We're like, oh yeah, that guy had all the signs. When you're looking forwards, you're like, that's like 200,000 kids in my city here. What do I, you know, who do I pick?
But what about, what I was getting at with the whole International Women's thing was I've always been under the understanding that violence towards women is always a prognostic factor for gun violence as yeah. well. Is it?
Well, and there, yes. So there, you know, domestic violence, a lot of that happens with a firearm, and the majority of murders of women happen from intimate partners. Firearms are a really big part of intimate partner violence and homicide. So violence against women is not, you know, people worry about like the random stranger trying to mug you or rape you walking home from work. You're most likely to be killed by somebody you know. And within that subset, it's most likely to be a partner or a former partner if you're female. And a lot of the mass shooters that we've seen in the last, I don't know, decade or two decades, I guess, have had a history of misogyny. And it's part of this whole kind of grievance thing of like, I am not recognized for my greatness. I deserve more than I'm getting. And a lot of times that actually translates into like, I should be getting laid and I'm not getting laid. And it's all these women's fault. And we've seen a number of mass shooters that subscribe to what's now called the incel philosophy, right. The voluntary celibates. But, you know, even before that was coined as a term, the Virginia Tech shooter had a history of stalking women. The Isla Vista shooter was really angry that he was still a virgin. And he thought that was just, you know, completely unacceptable. We've seen a number of these mass shooters really complain about basically women not giving them the attention and sex that they feel that they're due.
Classic. Yeah, the incel community is such a trip for me. Garrison, you spend a lot of time monitoring these weird groups online. Are you like watching incel chat rooms? And are these people, do they ever openly discuss violence on those things, or is it just sort of alluded to?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I look at a lot of threats online, whether vague or to a specific person, and that's always, you know, something that's something I try to catalog whenever someone, you know, makes like an actual threat of gun violence that's like, you know, has like a specific attribute. And then in terms of incels, that is something I watch. That is something that you can see. There's a lot of, I know a lot of far right researchers who have like been watching specific people for a long time. And then one of the people they've been watching goes and like does something, and they're like, could I have stopped this? Could I have like said something to someone? It's like, I've been watching this person get more and more extreme, and now they just killed like 5 people. Could I, yeah, like it's a really weird thing to talk to these people who are in these chats really watching, and then this person, you know, does something. I know just recently there was a conviction for someone who's identified as an incel who did I forget if it was a shooting or if it was another violent attack. There was some attack, I think, in Toronto like last year, within the person identified as an incel. That's one of the more recent ones that comes into my memory. You know, there is a reason why this is happening in mostly young white males. I mean, yeah, I have my own theories on this and just kind of how we're getting so isolated as a culture from each other, and we feel as if our actions have no actual consequence or they have no effect. We feel so kind of alienated from everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's like entitlement, and a lot of these people are feeling snubbed without having ever made an overture. Nobody's ever gone up to a woman or asked her out, and they're feeling snubbed and rejected. And there is like a little bit of, and Dr. Barnhart, there's a little bit of a delusion. Like there's this sense of being rejected, and there's this whole, like a story that you're telling within your head to create like venom and hatred and maybe ultimately violence. And it's hard. I would imagine even on these chat rooms, hard to pick these people out. And then, you know, again, I don't know if you have any data on that, Dr. Barnhart, or if you have data on right wing or extremist use of guns.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of good data, but I will say that like the whole incel thing and that idea that you mentioned about entitlement, like I deserve this. I was just born with the right to, you know, have lots of beautiful women falling all over me. Why is this not happening? It's not that different, and there's tons of sort of overlap in the ideologies of these guys from extreme racism, right? Like, I am entitled to this country because my ancestors got here 2 decades ago, and your ancestors just got here 1 generation ago. And so a lot of the shootings that we've seen in the last few years that have been racially motivated, they're not that far off from the ones that have been more like sexually motivated, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Like the El Paso shooting, that's a great example.
Right.
Exactly. That was exactly what I was thinking of.
That was anti-Mexican, right? That was just like xenophobia and racism and like, right?
Is that? But the kind of chat rooms someone like that's going to be on, there's going to be a lot of crossover between the type of kind of racist kind of undertones and just overtones, frankly, and the misogyny. And and the kind of entitlement. And the thing about like the entitlement thing is taught, whether that's like intentional or not, like not even like an individual passing it on, but it's like a product of how we have created media, how we've created our culture, how we've kind of created a lot of divisions between the different sexes and genders, and how there's like a weird, because like coming from perspective of like, of, you know, I am a younger white male. Now I'm not straight. But definitely I can think back to like earlier times of my childhood, and, you know, the idea of interacting with women my age is like a really weird taboo almost. Mm-hmm. And you get like shunned from all parties. You feel like you're gonna get shunned from women. You feel like you're gonna get shunned from parents, both your parents and the other person's parents. It's this kind of weird thing that we've done that's, like, I'm not trying to take blame away from these young people, like, you know, the actual perpetrators, because yes, it is absolutely your fault. But there are definitely things we can do culturally that make it so that someone's less likely to go down this extreme rabbit hole. There's certain things about normalization of interaction and making things just like less, like, you know, like having things be less like weirdly sexual at such a young age that can normalize interactions between people, that just so you get like a healthy friend group. Like that creates a way more stable person, right? Than someone who feels so isolated and alone. And because they're so isolated and alone and they feel weird to talk to anyone, they turn to these kind of internet communities that are toxic and self-perpetuating. So it creates a cycle, because then, you know, you're going to become someone who influences another young kid in 10 years because you're in these same chat rooms and it's the same problem and it never gets fixed.
So Dr. Bornhorst, along those lines, you know, we're talking about the difference between socialization, basically socializing kids better or in a healthier way. That sort of goes a little bit against what we've heard a lot in regards to, you know, people who don't want to change gun laws. They always talk about finding people with mental health issues. But I'm assuming a lot of these people in these groups where there's this misogynistic component, the incels or other groups, I mean, they probably would pass a mental health exam, right? They're not someone you could put on a 5150 or a hold. Or, I mean, are we looking at this wrong? Does our paradigm need to shift from, you know, we need to stop thinking, okay, there's crazy people that we have to find schizophrenics or whatever and make sure they don't have guns, and maybe find people who have these other social determinants? Are we looking the wrong way?
I mean, I agree with Garrison said, which is that there's a cultural component to this, and it's unfortunately very steeped in our American culture, which is that, like, anybody can be president, anybody can be a Hollywood movie star, anybody can, like, rise to the top, we're all exceptional. You know, it's very different from the ideology in other countries where it's like, we are part of the collective, we are all equal. You know, that's not how Americans think. And so then as Americans, if you're one of those guys and you don't get the things that you feel like you deserve just by virtue of existing, you get very angry about them. And that is a huge cultural problem. And then I think, again, like Garrison said, it's perpetuated by, especially right now, by being able to find others who reinforce it and perpetuate it on the internet, these chat rooms where it's like, yeah, I'm totally with you, buddy. Same. Like, we're the ones who are in the right here.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah, and like you end up with things like Pizzagate, which is like, how did people believe that there was this ring of like pedophile sex trafficking out of this poor pizza?
QAnon!
Right, or cute. How do people believe it's the QAnon? Same
thing. The thing is, like, there actually is explanations for these things, right? It is like, these things don't just happen, right? These things, there is reasons for why we can draw conclusions to this, and make, you know, make presumptions that everyone feels like, you know, there we've lost a lot of what used to hold cultures together. And I'm not like a traditionalist by any means, but, you know, like, I am like anti-religion, because I've had a lot of negative experiences with religion. But if you
ask, if you're telling us we all need to get back to the church,
I know, but I know, but like what I'm saying is like we like lost a lot of the things that kind of give people a traditional meaning, right, and the traditional purpose, a community around us that kind of helps us stay together, whether that be church, whether that be you know, some kind of organized religion, some kind of philosophy that kind of holds us together. You know, like nihilism as we know it now is a relatively new phenomenon. And I mean, I am a nihilist. I'm like an absurdist. I think those philosophies are intriguing to me and they help explain a lot of what I feel. But they definitely have their negative downsides. And in terms of there's increased alienation in the world, we feel like nothing we do really matters. It feels everything feels so big and distant. And because of like this American exceptionalism culture, we feel like we have to become like this like celebrity figure. We have to feel like we become this kind of hero. And then when that doesn't happen, we don't know what to do with ourselves. And then we get sad and depressed and we
angry.
And a lot of young men are going to turn to internet chat rooms where other people feel the same.
And we blame everyone else for our problems. Blame our high school peers who like didn't respect us enough. We blame the girls who wouldn't sleep with us. We blame the Latinos who were taking, you know, allegedly our jobs.
Taking our jobs away. We blame, all that kind of stuff.
I mean, to bring it back to Portland and the BLM movement, which is what we talked about with Garrison at the top of the show. I think a lot of this exceptionalism and its individualism and entitlement, these all go together. And that is the definition of America. And the root of all that is white supremacy. Like, I know we're four white people like talking about it, or like variations
of white.
I know variations of white. Don't worry. Everyone knows you're not like officially 100% white.
Thank you.
But like, but
I'm Canadian. So I make up for that.
Right. Yeah. You take us back to the other end of that curve. Yeah.
But I didn't love the book, but White Fragility is that book that, you know, is one of the best sellers of 2020. They talk about that. And that is part of the defining culture of America, is what you both are talking about, is this individualism, exceptionalism.
Yeah. White supremacy effects of kind of our modern capitalist ecosystem and the way we hold power, like, you know, our authoritative structures. All of these things, I think, contribute to these kind of these problems that pop up as what we could call like mental health issues, quote unquote. But I think, you know, all of these things are contributing factors to our modern kind of issues. I'm reading Tribe by Sebastian Younger, and he talks about a lot of this kind of stuff in comparison to how our modern society is built and arranged and how we feel about it as like humans and creatures in comparison to like societies in the past where we didn't really have these issues and we weren't as technologically advanced. But we had, you know, there's all these different trade-offs that happen, whether we, you know, we have more of a sense of purpose, we have more of a sense of like community, which, you know, prevents people from doing these kind of what we would be described as like, you know, mindless acts of violence.
I'm going to sum it up by saying fear leads to anger.
Anger leads to hate and hate leads to suffering.
Yes. and that's the last of Star Wars you guys are going to hear. So Dr.
Barnhorst, I had no idea. I was like, you guys both know a quote and I have no idea.
It could have been like a Buddhist quote for all you know.
It was super Buddhist-y. So
Dr. Barnhorst, before we leave though, I would be remiss, and we have to close up soon, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask about this story that you mentioned on your Twitter feed recently about plagiarism. Can you, because it kind of was amazing, could you please share that with, oh my goodness, Garrison's showing his cat to us.
This is my therapy cat, actually.
That's a really cute cat. That's a goddamn cute cat. Bobby's sorry. Okay. Anyway, cat person. I like cats. Okay. I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh yeah. So the plagiarism thing, it was really weird. Rocco, who is kind of my right-hand person at the Bullet Points Project, and we've worked together for a long time. She's a research data analyst at the UC Fireham Center. An editor reached out to me because I had written something for a journal that he worked at previously. So he reached out to me and said, hey, I'm writing this new journal. Would you be interested in writing something about firearm suicide? And I said, sure, me and my colleague and Rocco will take this on. Rocco took the lead on it. She wrote a paper. I was second author. I contributed a bit and did some editing and back and forth. We submitted it to the journal. And we went back and forth a bunch with the editor who wanted, like, we could tell that he wanted something a little different, but we couldn't quite figure out what it was he wanted. And then he was like trying to change some stuff that we were like, no, that's not actually correct. And eventually, after a few rounds of editing, we pulled the article and said, you know, and Rocco and I had a lot of backroom discussions about this. We were like, this is not going anywhere. It's taking up a lot of our time. Like,
yeah,
we gotta just pull the ripcord here and get out. So we did about last May. We just pulled the paper and said, thanks, but no thanks. We're going to take it elsewhere. At the end of December, we get an email from the editor saying, hey, I thought you might be curious to see what our journal had come up with about firearm suicide. And I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. And at first I click on it and there's a paywall, but I read the abstract and I was like, this sounds really familiar. And the authors on it are the editor and some other guy I've never heard of. And, you know, Rocco and I work in the firearm violence prevention and firearm suicide world. We're in the circle, right? And the circle's not that big. Like, we know the people. We know the names. So it's like, who are these guys? Then I looked at the bibliography and I was like,
that looks familiar.
It looks like just like all of our people. And so if he knows all these sources, how come we've never heard of him? Like, he doesn't seem to work with anyone we work with. So we finally got the paper out. And I've worked with Rocco enough. It was like if Rocco had called me on the phone but not said who it was, I would have known from her voice. Like, I read the paper and I was like, this is Rocco's voice. Like, even more than my own voice, I recognized hers. And I was like, what the hell? So I called her on the phone and I was like, have you read this? Like, look this over. Probably, I don't know, like 20 to 30% of the paper was literally copied and pasted from what we had submitted. And another 30% was like really bad plagiarism, you know, like changing big to large and like rearranging the adjectives. Like, it was like the kind of
like
stuff
what we did in high school, basically.
Yeah. And got busted for in high school.
Right.
Yeah. This is from the editor of a journal.
And then the rest was just lies.
Wait, why did he share it with you?
You said like 30, 30, and 30, right?
Wait, if they did that, why would he then have shared? Like, you wouldn't notice? Like, he thought you used to be cool with it?
These are the mysteries of the world, Kaveh. We don't know. And so then at the end of it, there was this kind of like philosophical diversion down this road of like the psychological underpinnings of violence and how to therapize it out of people. And that's not something we would have ever
did. Did they cure suicide and depression?
Really good therapy, super comfortable couch. You can actually just get it right out of people.
And a cat.
So did you get them to take it down?
Well, finally. So I emailed the manager or the editor-in-chief of the journal, whose response was first, like, let me investigate. I got to look into this. And then eventually he told me, and then eventually when he wasn't working fast enough, I said, I'm going to get in touch with the publisher. And he emailed me and said something like, you know, it'll be a lot better if we just handle this internally and you don't involve third parties. And that's when I was like, okay, I know what that means. So I went to the editor, and they did finally, about a month later, get a retraction out. I was just basically given like a letter saying like, we're sorry this happened. You know, this editor really thought that he had steeped himself in the material and believed that he wrote this, and it was all a big accident.
Were you like, the diagnosis is delusions of grandeur? Like, that is really incorrect.
Or like a cognitive, I don't know. Like, I have no idea what he could have possibly been thinking. And it would make sense that he just blatantly stole our work and published it in his own, if he hadn't emailed it to us.
Yeah, that's so weird.
You never would, right.
It was the perfect crime until.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right, that's great. Okay, well, let's tell people where we can find you guys. Can you give us your plugs, please? Let's start with you, Garrison.
At Hungry Bowtie, that'll be the main one. You can find out my other stuff from there. Right. That's on Twitter. I only use Twitter.
We'll link this, obviously. And you, Dr. Barnhorst.
I also am young and hip like Garrison, so I only use Twitter.
Totally.
So at Thanks. Amy Barnhorst, I'm on Twitter. And at Bullet Points Prod, you can follow my gun violence prevention curriculum for healthcare providers on Twitter as well. Lots of good tutorials and info there.
All right. Great. Hey, thank you guys both so much. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, nice to see you all.
Thank you.
Just four millennials hanging out, having a good time.
Yeah.
Or are we Gen Z?
I'm Gen Z. Yeah.
Okay. We don't know what we are.
We're millennials. Gen Z folks. Yeah. If you turn your Zoom filter up high enough, you really can look like you're about 26.
I didn't know that. I should turn mine down to look older.
Yeah, you could be like add wrinkles. I'm actually 72, but I dialed it back to like 40. So
well, awesome. It works. Dr. Von Horst.
Thank you guys so much.
Bye.
Have another sip of whiskey.
Okay. It's just for the Star Wars questions. I'm still really nervous about this.
Oh, no.
How much Star Wars are we going to do?
Garrison, you're going to carry us on the Star Wars stuff, okay?
Oh, no!
Wait, when you guys start talking about Star Wars, can I leave?
Yeah, you can go do something else for a little bit.
Super not into it.
Listen,
I have
to discuss the prequels.
I totally respect your need to do that, and I need you to respect my need to not be involved in that.
I hate you so much.
I hate you. I hope you
choke. You're the worst co-host. I'm going to kill you.
I hope you choke.
On my way to go get guns pointed at me at a rally.
Oh, man.
Good luck.
Now that I know you, I'm going to worry. I didn't worry.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employers. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.